In today's episode, we are talking with a guy who's giving away 10,000 euros plus 1% equity of a company he will build. The interesting part is you can provide a business idea. Everyone can provide a business idea. He will pick one, found his company, and the winner will get the 10,000 euros plus 1% equity. If you want to be part of this company, there's also chances to. We're talking about what exactly he's looking for with his experience of many companies founded and sold and invested into 75 startups. I think it's really interesting looking into what exactly he's looking for, because I think he has some understanding of what is important and what is needed when founding a new company. So really, really cool episode. Really enjoyed it. Let's get it started. So hello and welcome back to the Digital Economics Podcast. A new episode today about Frederick Fleck, who has an amazing idea. He's giving out 10,000 euros plus equity to a person who gives him the next business idea. Welcome to the podcast. And can you tell a little bit about you and about this pretty cool idea?
Luis, thank you for having me. It's wonderful that you reached out on LinkedIn and saw about my idea challenge. So I'm an entrepreneur. I've built several companies and sold the last one of those last year. And after taking some time off, I really felt there's at least another company in me which needs to get out to the world. But somehow, I used to solve my own problems, but maybe I don't have any problems anymore, at least not once solved by founding a company. So I reached out and thought there must be so many people out there who have great ideas, who see maybe problems and say somebody should fix that. But, you know, they are in jobs, maybe they have like a house, kids and a mortgage to pay. So I thought, why don't you pass on your ideas so we bring those great things to life. And obviously I want to have everybody to participate in that. That's why I'm offering that award. And everybody can just come to pitch.rvv.tv, my site, and talk to me, talk to my AI, and let me know about your ideas.
I was doing it myself because I could use 10,000 euros. I think everyone could. And it was pretty nice because it actually responded in detail to what you had written before. Did you program the AI yourself with a little script? Do you have an open AI connection, or how did you make the setup? Because it was not really a form. It was more like talking to a person.
Yeah, so that's what I love about AI. You don't really need to code. You know, way back, I was on the tech side and I haven't written a line of codes in ages. And there's so many great tools. So there's no big secret about it. It's actually a product by Typeform, but they've spun out kind of an own, I don't know if it's a company or just a team. Mm-hmm. It's called formless.ai. So it is indeed not a form. So I had to program it, not by code, but by prompting it, telling it what I want to achieve and what I'm interested in to learn about ideas. So I have to give it like rough section. But how it guides you through it, it's open to the AI. And I think it's really clever and witty. I'm not sure if you've done it in English or German. It works basically in almost any language. It really understands what you're saying and is responding to it. So it's fun. I think the best comparison I have in the old world is basically a good, you know, guide for telephone interviews where you, you know, certain things you need to cover, but you as the interviewer can guide the person being interviewed through it any way you see fit. And that's the same principle there. And I think it liberates a lot of people because I talk to friends and say, oh, I have this idea, but I don't know what to do it. I don't know how to write a business plan, or I don't have the time for it. So I wanted to have the threshold as low as possible. You don't need anything else other than talking to me by talking to my AI.
And it was actually created. It was like a really good experience for me because I was writing something, like that's my idea. And then it was asking me, yeah, but did you think about that? This could be a problem. And I was like, yeah, actually, I thought about this. This would be the solution. That's why I think. And you were just setting it up like, okay, please challenge the idea and ask the person, like, what could be a solution for potential problems, what could be potential risks, what are competitors, etc. So you were giving a general needs you have from this form, and everything else is created by the formless AI tooling itself.
Correct. So I wanted to know about the target group, how you make money with it, which geography you want to launch it to. So those kind of questions. But how it asks in what, in which order, all that is different. So if you run through it multiple times and everybody's invited to give me as many ideas as they like to, you know, you'll see the beginning is the same, the end is the same, where I thank you and ask you to connect with me on LinkedIn and those kind of things. But everything in between is always a little bit different because it depends on your input to it. And that's such a magic experience. And besides getting a lot of great ideas, that's one of the big feedbacks I'm getting, is that this AI is really fun to work with, to talk to. Mm-hmm. And I'm using AI all the way through. So AI kind of the tool to input the idea, but then it also summarizes the idea. Then I read every idea myself, but to give feedback, I'm using AI again to write the emails I'm sending out. So it's kind of a closed loop, and everybody gives me good feedback. Some write, oh yeah, probably you have written this email with AI, but still thank you. I see that it's still your thoughts. And I'm not like the writer type, so my emails are normally like very short, 2 or 3 lines. And obviously, if you put a lot of thought into it, that felt quite impolite for me. So, but I can still give my input to the AI and write them like half a page, really detailed, which I still check before sending out. But most of the time, I just send it out because great. Sometimes I alter it a bit. And for both sides, it's a fantastic experience. So that's, you know, I've done AI stuff before, but to go the full loop, I think it's great.
How many ideas did you got so far?
I think we are like 270, 280. It's really crazy. Okay, I was hoping for this kind of response, but this really went viral in a way. And, you know, most of the ideas are really thought through. It's, you know, some people are exploring with me. I think they just want to see what's happening, which is also fine. But there's almost zero spam, like really people's writing bullshit. So I'm very impressed by the quality also of the ideas I'm getting.
Could you imagine when there's a winner and the people are like, yeah, maybe we would like to work on this ourselves, to like work with the people giving you idea, like as a co-founding team? Or do you really want the ideas to build something from scratch on your end? Or are you open to how it will be in the end?
Yeah, so I've basically created 3 tiers how you can work with me. If it's just you have a great idea, but you know you're super busy in your life and that's it, then it's this kind of €10,000, 1%. If you're in a job, you don't want to leave your job, but you have a couple of hours every month where you can help me, where maybe you have a specific industry knowledge or something which really would be there, then come on board, kind of an advisor, board member, and you get €20,000 and 2%. And then ideally, somebody is totally fired up and want to found it with me together, then obviously we talk about like a co-founder package, equity, salary, and all the likes. So my goal is not to be a solo entrepreneur, but my goal is to really, again, step into the operational role, rolling up the sleeves and getting dirty to build something myself, ideally with somebody together.
Oh, I'm loving it. And I think it's really hard if you are not born into this world, and if you don't have rich parents or whatever, like to get into the startup world can be hard, can be tough. So there's the way of bootstrapping. But I think getting venture capital and some ideas need like marketing budget, et cetera, can be pretty hard. I think for some people, and I, Yeah, if someone is winning this, I mean, what a lucky person. I think it's a pretty good place to start from, with some budget, with like a person who is a great co-founder, and yeah, maybe someone's busy, and then it's also a great deal. Some nice holidays just by inviting a cool business idea. I really like it. Yeah.
No, wonderful. Thanks for your feedback.
Now, I wonder, you have now like almost 300 ideas. Maybe there will be 300 more. How do you want to decide in the long run who will be the winner?
Yeah, so for me, it's basically, I go like through a couple of criteria to pick an idea which I like. You know, one of the criteria, and I've just posted about that also two or three weeks ago on LinkedIn, it's basically, is it a painkiller or vitamin? So that's kind of crucial for me. I want to explain this kind of thing. There are a lot of things which are in this nice-to-have category. Oh, yeah, it would be nice to have, but do I really need that? Mm-hmm. Or is it like a painkiller, something I immediately get? And I've seen that in my own companies, in my portfolio, for example. I've built a company, Test.io, which does software testing. And it's super important. Everybody should obviously test their software so that it's bug-free, high quality, and just a great product out there. But then we always had the challenge that somebody in our customers, there was a controller, come, oh, why are we spending that money on testing? Do we need it? And then sometimes they churned. 3 months later, they came back because at some point they discovered, oh, the quality of my software is going down. I get bad reviews and that, but it's not immediate. Whereas, for example, another portfolio company of mine is called Close.com. They're building a CRM. So if their servers are down even like a couple of minutes, the phone would ring right away and they get lots of messages because people cannot work without the CRM even being up. And that's kind of what I mean more by being a painkiller.
And what else are you looking for? Because I think, Ben, you probably have out of 600 ideas, maybe 100 ideas now.
Yeah. So my next criteria is I love things which cover a recurring need. So what I mean with that is, you know, if I, for example, I just bought a house last year. If I'm a real estate broker, I sell to the same customer house only once, maybe twice in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to win a customer. We all know it. You spend a lot of money on it, but especially energy. And if you have only one time a customer, it's also very hard to get feedback. Whereas on the other side, staying with the example, for example, of a CRM system, if I won a customer over to my CRM system once, they need it every day because they're working it. And as long as I continue to deliver a good product and develop it, I will continue to have this customer and I can always kind of build the next cohort. I've got my first 10 customers, my first 100,000, 10,000 customers and build on that. And it's also important for the product development side because you always have the space and you can continue to go there. So I'm looking for ideas which solve a recurring need.
So best case is a subscription model.
It could be a subscription model, but this is basically a function. Because what I'm not looking for, you know, everybody remembers the ringtones and all those other kind of things. Are kind of in a subscription and then they forgot to quit. That's not a recurring need. Because the business model is subscription, but the person, the customer doesn't need a subscription. It's a problem where you really have a recurring need. And then obviously, yes, it can be subscription business model, but it can be other business models. But I start with what the user needs, because only if you solve their needs and give them a relevant product over time, they will be happy customers.
Understood. When you're writing in your last post something about scalability, not disruption, can you explain this also in detail?
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about it because everybody want to be disruptive and things like that. I think, you know, the this old saying, perfect is the enemy of good. A lot of people, oh no, this idea is not big enough and you will not be a $1 billion unicorn and somebody else is doing something out there. Mm-hmm. And I am looking for innovation, but I'm very happy if it starts in a specific niche. Mm-hmm. So like maybe only 10,000 people also need it at the beginning, but they are power users and super happy about it and really are advocates of a product. It's a great start. And then, you know, you can always imagine, okay, maybe then I add the service to it and then another 100,000 customers or whatever. Versus on the other side, you know, this, oh yeah, and I would just need 1% market share. If everybody in the world just 1% would use it, I would be a billionaire. Yeah. So that's not really what I'm looking for. I like to start in this niche, but then the scalable part. From there, I can grow and build it up.
Mm-hmm. And your last point also here, I really like your structure. I think not even for people who are listening to this podcast who are like right now applying for that and want to win, but also for people just founding a company, this is really interesting. The last point, customer accessibility. Can you explain this as well?
Yeah. So with accessibility, I mean that through marketing sales, I can reach the customer relatively easy and in good time frame. So like on the one extreme end, you know, you have like enterprise sales, products which take 12 months or more to win a customer. That means that A, it takes a long time to win a customer, but also your feedback loop is so much longer. Because yes, it takes 12 months and then the next customer 12 months. Whereas on the other side, you know, it doesn't need to be mass market consumer. But for example, my company Test.io, we had a sales cycle around 3 months. And then obviously, if you've done it a couple of times, you end up winning a customer every week or so. And you build up a few hundred of customers. That's already giving a good feedback loop, not only to have more revenue, but also to have more customers using your product. You get data, insights, and everything. So that's important for me, that I see a path how we can get to the customer. The first one is always hard, but then like think a year or two later, is a recurring again machine which can bring in those customers with who we can learn and grow together.
Talking about this, in your previous companies, was it a big thing for you that you were doing user interviews with people and like really tried to talk as much as possible to the users?
Yeah, especially in the early days, it's super important to, you know, go from an idea to, I call it by now only an MVT, a minimum viable test to test the idea. So it doesn't have to be the MVP, the product yet. A step four. So for example, if I have an idea, sometimes I create only a landing page for it. But to, as soon as possible, get something out there and talk to people, get the hard feedback versus spending a year in a lab and thinking I built the greatest product and then nobody wants to use it. And then iterative, going from kind of a landing page to the very first version of a product, the MVP, and going. I think it's true in any case, but once you're like a 50 or 100 person company, sometimes it gets forgotten and we need to remember to still talk to our users. But yeah, especially in this early phase, it's super important.
How do you think, so one thing I recognize is that startups are really, really connected to their users. So like many, many people I have here in the podcast are like stating that they really prefer like talking to the users in person, like having a video conference and like doing user interviews, asking for their needs, checking the usability of what they built. When a company is growing bigger, and this is what you mentioned, this is getting harder and harder. And then you sometimes have research people or something, but the management of a company is never talking to users. And I think this can be a problem. Do you think there's a solution for that problem?
I totally agree with you. The benefit of having a larger company, more customers, is that you have more data and therefore can also look into kind of usage behavior on those scales and try to learn from that. But I think there's no replacement in making user calls. I try to do like once a month, 2-3 user interviews, sessions in customer service also to still remain connected to it. I have to admit that I'm not perfect at that. It's not every month that I can do that. But I think you need to strive and combine the qualitative input you get from the data with the qualitative part. And, you know, maybe at some point you have a department looking after it, but still, if I do it myself, I hear things between the lines. I can I discuss my colleagues who hear other things. It's also very important, you know, if, for example, the tech guy talks to customer versus the sales guy, the same interview, they would hear completely different things and kind of the meaning in there. So it's, I think, very important to stay on that game.
I think it's really interesting that, for example, the founder of Airbnb is still like a host on Airbnb and is hosting people at his place and is staying at other people's places with Airbnb. If he could probably rent like crazy luxury hotels. But I think not only because he maybe likes the idea of Airbnb, but just getting like staying connected with the people you're building this platform for. It's so cool.
Airbnb, Google, my wife used to work for Google. They call it dog fooding, although I've got just a puppy, so I wouldn't really not like to try the dog food. But yeah, try your own product, your own user. It's super nice. Important.
Nice. I love it. Okay. And now having the idea of the perfect product, the perfect idea, if there would be a person who would say like, okay, I would like to be a co-founder of yours, how would your perfect co-founder would look like?
So the ideal co-founder is complementary to me in terms of skill sets. So I'm... Although my background is originally in computer science, but I fast went onto the business side of the kind of tech industry. So I'm more kind of the sales, marketing guy, fundraising, company building, all that. So ideally, I would find a technical co-founder. And that I think nowadays doesn't necessarily have to say somebody who knows to code. Can be also somebody who's kind of a great product guy, no code, cool tools and everything, but technical, process, structure minded. I think that's ideal. It's, you know, sometimes you have a three-person team, then somebody kind of who's keen on operations, accounting, and those kind of the more structure is also great. But that's kind of the skill. On the other side, on the values, I think it's very important that we are aligned. Because that has nothing to do with skills, but for example, for me, it's very important, you know, honesty, integrity, that we're open to each other, but also to our customers as well. But I also like to move fast, but then on the other side, I like to switch off. It's very important that I can, for example, take a weekend and spend with a family and know my team has my back and vice versa. Somebody offline, I know and respect that. So those are kind of value elements. I think that you need to align, and on the skill set, you need to be complementary, which means at the end of the day, complementary always sounds so magically and romantic, means that you're different. And sometimes this can also cause some friction at the beginning to understand those kind of things.
One thing with alignment, because I think it's one of the most controversial things right now within startups, is the topic of remote working. How do you think and how do you feel about people not going to the office at least 2 or 3 days a week and maybe being a digital nomad working from everywhere they want to?
So yeah, I'm a digital nomad or relocated. I'm living in Cascais, close to Lisbon now. I think it needs to be done very much by design. And I'm very about hybrid solution. Let me explain about that. So like one of my portfolio companies, long time before the pandemic, they made a decision that they want to be a completely remote company. And they spent really a lot of time, you know, there's great books out there, the founders of Automatic, the company behind WordPress, and the Basecamp guys. There's some good handbooks out there, learning from their experiences. And they basically said, okay, we are global and we meet once a quarter for 2 weeks somewhere vacation. We work hard during the day and party hard at night and therefore do the human connection. And this is not the only way you can do it. You can do it a mix. You can say you living in a wider area of a city, and then we are 1 or 2 days a week optional in the office. I think what I find difficult is kind of the hybrid parts. We're saying, okay, part of the team is global, but then there's kind of this inner circle who meet and they discuss things which are not open to the others. So however you need to do it, I think it's important that kind of everybody in the team is on the same level and that we get the non-transactional communication. What I mean by that is, if I have a Zoom call, if I Slack, it's transactional. I want something. Let's discuss this problem. Let's work on this and that. And that's very important. But we're missing is the creativity, which you traditionally get on a lunch break and get on a joint coffee, where you just talk about things and at some point things pop up and you need to see how you can recreate it, be it the group lunch, be it like this vacation where you get regular together. So I get a lot of energy out of meeting people and discussing with them. But I also don't want to be forced in an office and be there. I was a 9-to-5 CEO. It wasn't 9-to-5. I was a CEO who knew that the team would come just a few minutes before me and leave a few minutes after me. And therefore, I felt forced to spend a lot of time in the office. In hindsight, obviously, it's totally stupidity. But yeah, I think we are all learning about this new world.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that there are like people with really strong opinions about no, everyone should go to the office because you're losing so much. But at the other side, people who are like, no, I couldn't imagine like at all going to an office. I think something in the middle is actually pretty interesting because I mean, I love going to Munich right now to see my colleagues in person sometimes. But I also really enjoy that I don't have to ask anyone if I want to see my family for a week or something. And that's something where I don't recognize that it's like a burden on my work or something, because it doesn't matter if I'm working from Berlin or from the Saarland. Yeah. So I like your opinion about this. And interesting that you're thinking like this about it.
It's actually one of my recruiting thesis. So I'm living in Lisbon. We have a huge digital nomad community. A lot of people come for the weather, for the taxes and the lifestyle. So, there's so many big adventures. But after, you know, a year of working 5 days a week on Zoom, people are really getting tired. So I want to build my next company, which has kind of a loose base here in and around Lisbon, where people can come together. They get the community, we will have a co-working space and you can come from time to time. But then you are free to travel for time around and things like that. So I think in this case, a mix is great where everybody has those opportunities, but you have this home hub and people want this feeling of community, I think.
100%. I think that's really interesting because like many people, I think in the scene are really searching for freedom and like not being bounded and whatever. But still, like, I mean, I don't really have a need to go to a WeWork, but almost every day I'm like, yeah, no, I don't want to spend all day at home. I would get crazy here. And next week we will be on Madeira and we're also like all the digital nomads who have their beautiful places where they stay. Come together to this digital nomad village and are working in this co-working space. It makes absolutely no sense. Like the internet is great everywhere. They often don't even talk with each other, but it's nice sometimes just to have a place where other people are, where you're seeing someone. Yeah, I really feel this thing of, okay, I need to go to a place to work. And I cannot... I have to leave sometimes these 20 square meters. Talking a little bit about like your past, I think that's interesting. How did that started that you decided to found a company? I think the first one, which was really your company, was Donare.de. which was an idea of your wife. Is this correct?
Yes. So Donare was our kind of charity. So this was not a full-time project for us. It was the fulfillment. I had just had my exit with my very first company. It's Estrich Media based in London. And I just sold that. And then we set it up to, you know, also give a little bit back to the community. But, you know, thinking back, it's really, I got started during high school, building computers, selling mobile phones, and then kind of been sidetracked by business schools and almost started an investment bank. But then I got the urge again and joined a startup. I was one of the very first employees there. So it felt like being entrepreneur already then and building companies in the first.com wave in Berlin.
Yeah, it was like 2000 or something when you were doing this, right?
Yeah, it was kind of the hype of the first.com, and within a year it was also the bust, and everybody, you can't imagine, everybody had to leave Berlin at that time because there were no jobs in Berlin. But we were one of the few survivors of that phase.
How did this whole like bubble bursting thing felt like? Was it like, okay, it's over, this beautiful place called internet? Or were you like really confident, okay, but it's useful, like people will come back using all these technologies and these companies again?
Yeah, at that point it was quite hurtful because it was fragile. I mean, I didn't think that the internet would completely go away, but people need to move away. There were no jobs in that. And it took a couple of years to come back. I mean, now it's a long time ago. We are much more safer. One company will fail, or, you know, the stock price will go down and things like that. But, you know, tech will always be there. And we're just seeing it. And Vida goes from one high to the next and gets the entire market up and going. And I'm very happy that the ecosystem has evolved and is so stable as it is now.
And in like 5 years later, probably still like a situation where everyone wasn't 100% sure about economy, not 100% sure about that, but I think so. You felt like, okay, I want to found like my TV company.
Yeah. So we had just sold the company I was working in at that time, and I took basically the same concept with some twists to it, and this was an internationalization game. So my company was based in London, where we had already kind of tested the market a little bit before, and then I rolled it out. I think that was only 2.5 years. It felt like ages. You know, sometimes they say dog years. One human year, seven dog years. I sometimes feel that, you know, one normal life year is like 10 startup years or something like that. But yeah, in that short time frame, we did, I think, 5 countries. I rolled it out into Spain, Portugal, South Africa, even had like an adventure to China, yeah, and then the UK itself. So it was great fun. It's one of the elements I get a lot of energy from is kind of living and traveling internationally, seeing how things are done in other markets. It's fantastic.
But what exactly did you do? Like interactive TV company for me is nothing. Maybe because it's not IT, I guess. What does it mean?
So the interactive part is what we did is basically quiz shows. And think about like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire style of quiz shows. But you could participate from home. And mind you, that was before smartphones. So we used kind of phone calls, text messaging, and those kind of things to interact. So we brought interactivity to quiz shows online.
Okay, nice. Okay, and then a few years later, we have Test.io. So how did you come like from Oystrich Media to Test.io?
Yeah, this was a classic situation of scratching your own itch or solving your own problems. I was actually working with two developers on completely different. It was an e-commerce product, and we were two developers and me, so maybe counted 2.5. And we didn't have the budget to hire more people. We either had the situation that we, you know, met our deadlines by shipping the next version, but then we had a lot of bugs, get complaints from customers, or we tested the product ourselves. The quality was great, customer happy, but we spent too much time and therefore we're past our deadlines. So as I couldn't hire more developers, I didn't have the budget, I thought, okay, what could I do to do both? High quality product plus meet my deadline. And I came up with the idea to outsource the testing part, or I was looking for solutions like that, but didn't really find any. And then we played around with some options, and that basically led to Test.io, where we have a crowd testing option. So it's on the one hand side, a software as a service application where you can upload. It became then very popular with mobile app designers. Upload your app and say, okay, it should be tested on this kind of devices, this kind of operating system. And then we have a crowd, by now it's a couple of 100,000 freelancers worldwide, who actually test it the wild, in real conditions, and report back the bugs we have, so that then the developers can rectify them before it ships to the public.
Okay, crazy. Okay, well, that's really, really useful. I should have something like that for our team. Because like right now we don't have a QA engineer, so that's a little on my end. And I think it makes people feel better if it's really, really tested before things are going live. Okay, nice. Cool idea. And you sold that company as well in 2019, right?
Yeah, so I started the company in Berlin, but while I was still living in San Francisco, we built it first kind of for the German-speaking market, but then very fast I won the first customers in the U.S., and then we focused a lot on the U.S. By the time we sold it, about 75% of new customers were already coming from the U.S., and we had a great team, Phil, a fantastic CEO, and 35 people or so at that time in Oakland. So we sold it to a U.S. company, to EPAM, and it has been developing really well ever since. I think last year they still did 60% growth or so. So it's fantastic to see it flourish.
Nice, nice. Cool. And then you were into Expert Cloud for many years. Explain what Expert Cloud is doing.
Yeah, so obviously by now, post pandemic, and we talked about working remotely, everybody knows that when we started, it was a total innovation. It was basically work from home for customer service agents. I'm not sure if you've ever been in a call center. It's not a very comfortable place to work. You have like a small cubicle, it's very loud. And we said, why? Why do people need to go into an office? They can work from home, either doing calls or emails or chat. So we built a platform which basically trains, motivates, controls people working out of the home office in that specific industry.
And you were like on both sides, right? You were connecting, like making the setup for business partners, but you were also hiring people who could assist in this context.
Yeah, so we built like a turnkey solution. We built a tech platform, but then also had the freelancers who were offering the customer service. And then on the other side, like companies like Mr. Spex or Axel Springer or large kind of players who, when you called them, you know, it was answered by one of our freelancers.
Okay, nice, nice. Yeah, typical case of, yeah, why does someone really has to go to an ugly office instead of like chilling at home and doing the same thing?
By now it's clear and obvious, but it took us a long time and a lot of questions. How can that work? And are people actually working, or do they take a Mickey at home and all those kind of things? But, you know, if you measure performance, have a good spirit there, you don't need to control them by micromanaging people.
Hmm. Did COVID help to get this hockey stick phenomenon?
It certainly helped in, you know, educating the industry and partners and really getting acceptance for this kind of service. And obviously by now it's mainstream.
And you also sold that company. Is it public? Is it something you're talking about? Like, you sold so many companies. Like, how much money this organized for you? Because, I mean, now you're also, like, working as an investor somehow. Like, you have some projects where you put some money on. So do you talk about, like, which amounts of money we're talking here if you're selling a company?
So, you know, it always sounds so easy, and oh, you just sold this company. You have to see. Expert was 13 years in the making. So when I sold it last year, it was 13 years after I founded it. So the good old saying, you know, every overnight success took years in the making is certainly true about that. You know, I'm under NDA, so I can't say the exact amounts, but, you know, it's Not unicorn, but everybody was very happy with the results.
Okay. You got an amount which made you happy. And emotionally, I think, if you're doing something for 10 years or more, it's crazy if you're stopping doing that and should do something else. Like, emotionally, how does it feel to sell a company where you worked for 14 years?
So, you know, I really like to look my life kind of in phases, or also, I think you're a surfer, you know, like waves. I like to catch a long wave, you know, not just, you know, a couple of months and then something new. I like the continuity, and I really like also to build something and really get it to something and not just, you know, really quickly blow something up and then pass a hot potato to somebody else. But on the other side, I also like to do something new. I love to explore things. I love to dig deep into something. And I'm really happy with the freedom I'm having right now that I can choose. It's also, you know, a challenge sometimes, I have to admit, to know what to choose and find the right thing, but to really dig into that. And so I like this kind of rhythm as an entrepreneur, 5-10 years, a business, and at some point start something new.
And until you start something new, we talked about this in the beginning, you're at the moment at two companies, Awork, which we also had on the podcast, and OX8 in the advisory board and supporting these companies. How does this look like?
So, you know, I really like the circle idea, you know, giving and receiving in the community. And I do a lot of work as a mentor coach. I'm part of EO, the entrepreneur organization. I had really great mentors in my past. I like to pass this on. And sometimes in the form of a board, this is relatively new for me. I've had boards in my own companies, but kind of for external boards to be there. So I'm experimenting with it a little bit, want to be selective, so I still have time for my new venture. But I always start with great people. So Tobias, who was on your podcast, I met 2 or 3 years ago and always stayed in touch. And he's such a great guy, complete integrity, his entire team, great guy, great product, which I love. And I just want to help them get to the next level. So that's fantastic. And then you talk to OX8, that's actually very old friends from university times, and they started their own company as an M&A advisor about 5 years ago or so, and also see them grow and flourish. So it gives me a lot of great feedback, a great feeling to be supporting other entrepreneurs as well.
And with your investment company, can I call it like this? Is Richmond View Ventures like a private equity investing venture capital company? How would you call it?
It's more my personal holding. I would consider myself a professional hobby. So I'm considering myself more to be an entrepreneur. But, since my first exit, which was over 15 years ago by now, I started to invest in business angels. Again, a little bit kind of supporting other entrepreneurs and nurturing the ecosystem. And, it sounds crazy. I once counted, I've done about 75 deals or so. But, if you do it a long time, it's only 3 or 4 deals a year. So I see 100 things a year and invest into 3 or 4. So I'm very selective, but it's also kind of opportunities where I can, have a check, but then also support the entrepreneurs behind it. And for me, it's, being engaged, having an ear on the market, what's new, what's the latest. And, I can't complain. The returns were also well. My first unicorn with Instacart went to the stock market, and the lockup just ended, and I'm kind of eager seeing the share price even going higher. So it's great to see that as well. But then on the other side, obviously, I also had a lot of write-offs. That's part of the journey there.
Yeah, I was scrolling through the portfolio, the companies you were investing in. And I was like, oh, where's the Code University? And then I was like, oh, where's Instacart? Crazy. And what is your connection with Y Combinator?
That's a very interesting story. So I lived at that time in San Francisco when Y Combinator was started. And then in kind of the second cohort, but in the first year, a friend of mine got accepted. I was already an investor. So probably the first and last time I can say I was in a company before Y Combinator was. And Stanley is the CEO of Closer.com, built a great business, was completely an alumni network of that as well. And through that, I got in touch to a lot of people and I invest in a lot of Y Combinator companies. And alongside this Y Combinator, this just fantastic ecosystem which they have been building there.
So you would recommend startup founders if they are thinking about it, like Y Combinator is worth it? Because totally. I love for a library, insane.
If you can get in, I would totally recommend it. Having said that, you need to know that's very different to what a lot of German and European accelerator do. It's totally loose. I'm not sure if they're back to presence or do it online, but even if you're there in San Francisco, it's only one afternoon a week. They have an office hour. Obviously, then sometimes Zuko or other guys turn up and give you feedback, so it's totally worth it. But it's not something where somebody tells you how to do it. It's it's a network. It's like, you have a MBA on your resume, it's about which one you have, but the network is like worse in gold. I mean, they have hundreds of alumni. It's very close together. They help each other. Obviously, it's great for fundraising, but it's primarily for entrepreneurs who know what they are doing and want to have a little bit network and kind of the brand on YC on not their CV, but what I mean, kind of for their company.
I'm so happy that they are existing, because I think sometimes all this knowledge is kind of exclusive, and Y Combinator just made it open public for everyone who wants it, and all the good information are online now on YouTube, and I think, not 100% sure, but I think I watched every video of Y Combinator, and I think everyone was worth it. And last week I had Nalen from Storylane in the podcast, who was also a part of one of the last Y Combinator batches. And just a cool ecosystem.
Fantastic. Still Hacker News, although the design is kind of so old school, but you know, it's a very
I want it like it.
Yeah, no, I know it's intentionally.
Nice. Okay. And to close all of this, like with all these like experiences and building your own companies and with all your experiences with investing into 75 companies, now you want to start a new thing. If someone has a great idea, chances are to win 10,000 euros and people should be quick because 15th of March is the deadline for applications. Let's call them.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, whoever is listening to this, please come to my site, pitch.avv.tv. Because you can probably also kind of
I will
send out a link with that. Perfect. And, you know, you don't need anything. You need obviously an idea in your head, but you don't need any papers or anything prepared. You can just talk to my AI. It's a little bit like talking to me, and I'm looking forward to hearing all of your great ideas.
If someone's listening this later this year, any chances that something like this will come back at any time, or do you want to focus on one company at a time?
That's my goal, to find a company at a time, but let's see where we are later in the year. And in any case, please feel free to just ping me on LinkedIn. I'm always trying to help ideas come to life and, you know, people becoming an entrepreneur. So it's not the end of the game, but just a new beginning. So I'm always open to chat with people.
Nice, nice. Great ending. Really, really cool project you're doing. Yeah, I'm so excited. Who will get the 10,000 euros? I guess there will be a LinkedIn post about this. Yeah, excited. What cool idea came up. And yeah, thank you so much for being today in my podcast.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
To everyone listening, good luck winning 10,000 euros. Yeah, I think it's just a really cool project. I like the approach. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the episode, please share it with friends who need 10,000 euros and have cool business ideas. Yeah, like it, give it a review, whatever you can do on the platform you're listening to it. And yeah, if you like the show, subscribe and see you in the next episode. Bye bye.